This is 4:55 on Monday, November 14th.
Scores out of 100. The average was 74.6 and the median was 76. And this is about 15 points higher than the first exam. I'm much happier. Thank you. That's much better showing than what we saw before. I'm going to go over the exam in a video and post that for Wednesday's lecture. Remember, there is no in-class lecture on Wednesday, so the recording will substitute for that. But I want to explain why it's out of 100 instead of 105. So if you will turn, please, to problem 4 on page 4. Problem 4A is fine. Problem 4B is another one of those problems where there was no correct answer. And what's worse this time is that I think I told you that there was a correct answer in class, and then as I got to thinking about it, I realized, well, no, the correct answer, what I had in mind for the correct answer wouldn't work. So here's the thinking. So suppose you put the two circles in such that they form corners of a rectangle, of a non-empty rectangle, right? Then you have two rows and two columns, right, that have bad parity, and you don't know which corners of the rectangles those correspond to. So it's ambiguous as to which are the arrow ones. So I thought, okay, that's pretty obvious. So how about this is what I was thinking, suppose the two errors are in the same row or the same column, okay? Then we get a clear indication of which opposite thing they're in. But in that case, the parity bit for the row or column that they're in is correct. It isn't incorrect. And so you don't know where the errors are. So, this is kind of an interesting social sort of phenomenon, I think, because I said this in class, and we all sort of blithely went on thinking maybe this was true or maybe not, right? And that's the social phenomenon idea here is how do we respect? What sort of respect do we give somebody in a position of authority, who tells us something? Do we just believe them, or do we think about it for ourselves? Okay? And if we do think about it for ourselves, do we actually raise it as a point of contention or not? And so I think that's... It's an interesting learning experience, and I'm happy to give up five points on the exam for at least me and hopefully you to have that learning experience. Go ahead.
During the exam, I did ask you, the book did say that any combination of two bit errors cannot be correctly pointed out.
Right. And then I contradicted that,
right.
And nobody further challenged it.
It is during an exam.
What?
It is during an exam.
No, but I mean, I contradicted it in discussion,
right?
I mean, I wouldn't expect people to challenge it during an exam, right? That's sort of not the point. The point is that it sort of came up in discussion and we didn't actually work through it. So, you know, this is kind of interesting. Of course you're here at the university to learn from people who claim to be experts about things. And on some things we are, and maybe on other things we're not. And thinking about where that distinction is part also of education. So anyway, that's why there are 100 points on the exam, because I threw out question 4B. All right. So that was that story. Now,
So I will post the video with the solutions and a discussion of the solutions for Wednesday's lecture. We are ready to move on and start talking about wireless networks. Before we do that, just one other thought. Does anybody else have any sort of reflection about this issue of intellectual expertise and your relationship to it? Anybody want to share anything, or other situations where that's occurred? Or am I the only one, or only professor who ever made this?
I mean, happens sometimes. I mean, it also depends on like how confident you feel with the subject. I feel like if you're kind of shaky, then mm-hmm. maybe you'll just accept the professor's mm-hmm. Explanation. If you feel more confident, you're like, well, I still
I think approachability is a huge part of it. I mean, you're pretty approachable, so I mean,
I'm pretty approachable, I think, and yet people still didn't. What was that?
Built in from other instructors.
Well, and that's kind of scary, actually. It's built in from other instructors. I think really you're here in the university to learn to think for yourself. That's the whole goal, really, of university education. It's why we make you take general education classes in addition to your technical classes. Because there's a lot of history of the world that informs thinking for yourself. So anyway, all right. Well, thank you. And I'm sorry about the problem. Hopefully it didn't throw anybody off too badly. Why does it say that? We are ready to start talking about wireless networks. Michael, you can see me afterwards for your exam. Wireless networks. We're not going to spend too long at this. There are some differences with wireless that need to be taken into account. And the point of this chapter, from my perspective, is to help you understand those differences. It's not to make you an expert on all the technologies that go into wireless, which are sort of deeply theoretical in some sense, but how does it show through to those of us who want to use wireless networks? And that's really what I want to get at. So, this was 4 years ago, wireless phone subscribers exceeds wired phone subscribers 5-1. That's probably worldwide and not in the U.S., but we're probably getting there. Wireless internet-connected devices equal wireline internet-connected devices. That's completely blown out of the water right now, right? Everybody's phone is a wireless internet device now, and so the previous number tells you that the second bullet has got to be false. However, wireless comes with some new challenges, and that's what we're going to talk about in this chapter. So, first thing we're going to talk about is the links, and then we're going to talk about mobility. Because wireless makes it possible for us to move around, right? That's one of the big advantages. We've got a network. It's got now graphical language for wireless is little antenna towers with beams coming off of them, and access points and phones with beams coming off of them. Interesting. Of course, we call those hosts, right? Just like we did for the wired network, and then we have some infrastructure in the form of base stations, cell towers, and so forth. They are typically somehow connected to the wired internet world. Sometimes those cell towers have wireless links to other locations, and sometimes they are in fact themselves wired into the network, it doesn't matter a whole lot from the perspective of the users. I said that. So what does the distance that a wireless base station can cover depend on? Any thoughts about that? How far does a wireless signal go? What does it depend on? What was that?
Geography.
What's in the way, right? That's one issue. Also, geography in the sense of things that are higher up have fewer things in the way, basically. The wavelength or the frequency of the radio transmissions, because that affects the physical absorption of the signal by different things.
Not just geography, but what material or what's in the way too.
Yes, what specific material is in the way matters. What else? How about power? The transmitter power. That's a huge factor that comes into play. And what's that?
Quality of material that's sending, right? If you have newer technology, you can go further.
So the quality of the code, I would say the quality of the coding, right? So remember, it's like any channel, you send this physical signal over it, it gets interfered with, and depending on how it is encoded, how the digital information is encoded on that physical signal, you may be able to do things like error detection, error correction, which will make things work possibly over longer distances. Yeah. Let's see, anything else?
I think we're...
Well, yeah, okay, so, so those things sort of ultimately translate into transmitted power. So transmitted power in the direction of the receiver, right? That actually turns out to be important. So we will talk about frequencies. We won't talk much about power. We'll talk a little bit about coding. So here's a chart that lays out some of these standards.
Um, 56 kilobits a second, 384 kilobits per second. This 2G, 2.5G cell phone service is pretty well gone from the world. We're sort of up to 3G minimum, 4 megabits per second, 4G, what's that for G? 5G, LTE, 4GE, 4G LTE, WiMAX is gone from the world, didn't work out so well. Access points, like around campus, numbers like 802.11. Those are we sort of bandy them about, right, as if we knew what we were talking about. But what they really are the standards that are associated with these different technologies. And so there's no real technical meaning in the name. It just happens to be the different name of a different standard, which then refers to different sorts of technology. Michael,
what's the difference between the AG and the AG point-to-point?
So this would be apparently AG for a base station, and then getting to Andrew's remark about antenna configurations. If you're able, so in a base station configuration, right, you have a base station and it has to be able to talk sort of in all directions. Mm-hmm. A point-to-point connection, you aim the antennas directly at one another. Okay? And so you get more power delivered to the receiver antenna.
as a result. That's my guess. The other issue would be that on an 802.11 AG point-to-point, you're not having to implement the protocols for media sharing, right? So, so again, you probably recover some of the bandwidth for that, although it's hard to... although I'm sort of talking in opposite directions here. Because this dimension is actually distance and not speed, and I'm talking as if it were faster, and it shows on the graph it being slower. So then maybe it's because of the distance. Okay. So just a little bit of a map. Oh, 802.15. These are our garden variety Wi-Fi networks. This is Bluetooth. There's a new version of Bluetooth called Bluetooth Low Energy. I haven't actually ever seen anything about it. My daughter worked on some projects for Intel using Bluetooth Low Energy, and it's the thing that, let's see, what is it that you get with Bluetooth Low Energy that regular Bluetooth doesn't have? There's some feature. I don't remember. I was thinking of that. I have some device that requires Bluetooth Low Energy, but what is it? And it wouldn't make sense with ordinary Bluetooth. Oh. Yeah.
So wasn't 4G like mainly for security reasons? I heard that they upgraded that.
No. 4G is higher performance.
Higher performance. I know. Like I was reading about something called the D-catcher. It catches like.
Uh huh.
Supposed to be harder, I guess, for 4G to like break what people are saying or something.
Could be. That doesn't surprise me, because this issue of security is an ongoing challenge, and so a newer standard ought to make progress on the security front. But I think the main reason that people buy it is fast. Right.
Maybe the main reason they should buy it is for security, but actually buy it for, because it's faster. Okay. Mobility. Stations move between one location and another. I guess this doesn't show up so much with Wi-Fi networks. I mean, it's nice if I can connect here and wander back to my office and not have to log in again and all of that. But where it really matters is with cell phone connectivity, right? Because people do expect their cell phone conversations will persist as they're driving down the road, moving from one cell phone tower to another. That would be really not a good service if every time you drove 5 miles down the road, you had to redial your phone. Or maybe it would, because then maybe people would stop talking on the phone so much while they're driving, and that would be a good thing. Okay. All right. So a couple of different ways of setting up Wi-Fi networks. There's so-called ad hoc mode, which is when a bunch of wireless capable devices are within range of one another, and they sort of form a network on their own. There's no requirement for a base station. Ad hoc mode. And typically because there's no base stations, there's also no internet connectivity. Right? They're just talking to each other. You see this sometimes with wireless printers. Those, but just the ability to walk up to a printer and print wirelessly to it might be done using a sort of ad hoc mode. The so-called infrastructure modes, we have base stations, Bluetooth is an example of something that's purely ad hoc. Okay, the other interesting point in this space
is this multiple hop space. So suppose we've got a bunch of people who all have wireless capable devices on their roofs, and they don't want to pay for internet service, but they want to share some public internet service. They can start building their own network to route messages amongst themselves. So called metropolitan area networks, rooftop networks. And the other use of this thing down here, this no infrastructure one, you often see discussions of so-called sensor area networks or sensor networks, where the Department of Defense is really fond of these, right? They would like to be able to fly an airplane over a potential battlefield and drop accelerometers, chemical sniffers at some fairly low density across that area, and ultimately be able to get back reports from that field of sensors about what's going on in that space. And the sensor area networks will organize themselves. You don't know where they're actually going to land, right? You drop them out of an airplane, so they land sort of somewhat randomly in this space. And they have to organize themselves into a network. There's a lot of research on that. Okay, let's talk about wireless links then. So here are some of the issues that crop up relative to a wired link. First of all, the signal strength of radio signals in the air is typically much, much lower than the signal strength of signals carried over copper wires over any reasonable distance. So, you know, when you put a Ethernet signal over copper wires, the voltage variations may be sort of between 0 and 2 volts, or between minus 1 volt and plus 1 volt, right? With a radio antenna, you get millivolts or microvolts of signal strength, technically. Okay? So that's even when they're close, and then we move them apart and we have these problems about absorption of signals and so forth, and things go down. All right, so that's one thing that people have to deal with in these wireless links. A second one is that in wireless links, there's always interference. We didn't mention interference as an issue, but there we go. We should have. Interference from other radio sources. So the 2.4 gigahertz band, which is very popular for 802.11, cell phones, not cell phones, wireless phones, all kinds of stuff operates in the 2.4 gigahertz band. Microwave ovens operate in that band. And all of those sources can cause interference with the radio signals. Another problem is multipath propagation. If I send a radio signal from here to you at the back of the room, there'll be a signal that reaches you this way, and there'll be another one that reaches you off of that wall, and another one that reaches you off of that wall. And those signals taking different paths take different times to get to you, and what is the result? Self-interference. Right? The direct signal is interfered with by the ones that come on opposite paths. Once upon a time, before the days of digital television, we used to be very aware of multipath propagation of television signals because it was the cause of so-called ghosting in the television image. You would see the main image, and then just slightly to the right of it, because it was left to right, there was a weaker signal that was the signal on an alternate path. Okay, so we don't have that problem anymore, but that's multipath.
And then there was other things. I'll come back to that other slide. The other problem that... Yeah, Edward.
You can still ghost current TVs with software-defined radio. It just turns the screen black instead of the
image. Right, because the current digital schemes say either it's working or it's not. And if it's not working, then they give up. So we're not as aware of ghosting as multipath as being an issue. What? It's not as cool, exactly. Okay, so here's another issue that crops up in wireless networks, and it's called the hidden terminal problem. And it happens because we've got, when we have three devices or more, but three is all it takes, where one of the devices can hear both of the others, but the other two can't hear each other because of an obstacle in between. So that's the hidden terminal problem. And as we're going to see when we look at channel negotiation, this is a real problem because the techniques that we talked about for wired networks don't work so well anymore. Because of this. We'll see why. Okay,
I'm going to go back one slide.
This is the remark about coding. So, signal strength is, in this physical realm, measured in a quantity called signal-to-noise ratio. And basically, it doesn't really matter how strong the signal is. What really matters is how strong is the signal in relationship to the noise. Right? We could have a very strong signal, we could also have a lot of noise, and it wouldn't be any good. So it's measured in this ratio, and the ratio is then expressed in a form that is called decibels, dB. Those of you who are electrical engineers know all about this, right? How many people are electrical engineers? Computer engineers. How many people know about dB? A few. All right. So, signal to noise ratio. Take the signal. In fact, I'm simplifying just a little bit. Take the signal, take the level of the noise, divide the two, and you get a ratio, right? When you measure that ratio in dB, what you do is you take the log to the base 10 of that ratio. Okay? So, and divide it by 10. Is that right? Multiply by 10. Take the log of the ratio and multiply by 10. Okay? So, log the base 10. So, a factor of 10, right? Factor of 10 between one signal and the other is, take the log of the base 10 of 10, you get 1, multiply by 10, you get 10 dB. Good. Turns out that a ratio of 2 is conveniently 3 dB, more or less. That's what engineers think, right? Ratio of 2 is 3. Okay, so what this graph is showing is that depending on what sort of coding scheme we're using and what sort of signal-to-noise ratio is being achieved, this isn't something that you have much control over on a moment-by-moment basis. You have your transmitter power, you have your noise, you have the physical characteristics of the path. At the receiver antenna, you get some signal-to-noise ratio that you don't have a lot of chance to control. It says that depending on the coding scheme you're using, you will get a bit error rate that looks something like this. And so you might say that
one bit in 100 is bad. Not so good. Fancier coding schemes can achieve higher speeds, but they require higher signal to noise ratios as well in order to do that. Okay, so that's just sort of a general discussion of that. We're not going to go into DBs and bit error rates and coding schemes on the exam. It's just sort of part of the general knowledge. All right. So back to a hidden terminal problem. The person who drew this graph was not really up on their physics, were they? What should these graphs look like? As you go farther away from something, how does the signal strength decrease? Not exponentially. Quadratically or cubically, usually. Well, and again, it sort of depends on the antenna and the physics of the actual channel layout. But I don't think you usually see something where you get to a certain distance and then it falls off precipitously. Yeah?
Is it that accurate if they're on the same wavelength? There's going to be an interference that is going to stop the signal from going as far when you're in the other one zone.
Yeah.
So it's not quadratic when you have multiple signals.
When you have multiple signals? Okay, I'll take that under advisement. But that would suggest to me that
I don't think it's that drastic.
I don't think it's that drastic, and I don't think it's that flat either. But maybe it doesn't really matter for the point that's being made. The point being made is that at B, A and C signals interfere with each other to the point that the signal to noise ratio here is lots of noise and no signal. And so B is not able to read either one of those signals if they're going on at the same time. And similarly, A is not aware that C is transmitting at all. That's the other issue. So what are we going to do about that? One technique is to use something called code division multiple access. And this is a good trick, and it isn't something that even existed when I was taking my ham radio license exams and learning about radio stuff. It's all been made possible by by advanced signal processors on microchips, and it actually allows these signals to all be there and sort of interfere with each other at a physical level, but then extract the intelligence from the signal nevertheless. And the way it works is you take the signal you want to send and you multiply it by what's called a chipping sequence, which is a signal that changes much more rapidly than the signal that you're sending. We're going to see a picture of this. And at the other end, you decode the signal by multiplying the encoded signal by that same chipping sequence, and you recover the original signal. So let's look at that. I just want to get all these up here. So
So here's our chipping sequence, and notice that it's repeated from slot 0 to slot 1, and it's multiplied by the original signal to produce the output signal. So, I think if you, hopefully they did that right. These are ones and minus ones. You could equally call them zeros and ones and do XORs on them. But multiply them together, you get something that looks like this. And anybody who's listening to that doesn't necessarily see what it means. But a receiver
who has the same chipping sequence.
Multiplies this slot 0 signal by the chipping sequence and ends up with the original value
and does the same in the next time slot
and ends up with the
original value there. Okay? I think what what this does is it sort of distributes the energy of the noise across the signal in such a way that you're still able to cover it. Now this is an example where we have two senders and we observe that we do the multiplication just like we did before, but the two senders use different chip sequences. The channel is assumed to be additive, so the signal that you get here and the signal you get here after doing that multiplication get added together, and now we have something that really doesn't look at all like either one of the original signals, but either receiver, when it multiplies the combined signal by its own chipping sequence, in fact it's original. And of course there's lots of noise in this, and it's sort of statistical in its actual behavior, but it works rather well. However, that's not what happens in it. That's a technique I believe is used in the cell phone networks. In 802.11 networks, Wi-Fi, we spread things using a chipping sequence like that, not for the purpose of eliminating interference between the wireless hosts, but for the purpose of eliminating interference with other devices and perhaps other devices using other wireless networks on the same channel. So that's the idea here. So within a given wireless LAN, we're all using the same chipping sequence because the base station has to talk to all of us. Okay. So the technique here is CSMA/CA. So we had CSMA/CD before, collision detection. The technique here is CSMA collision avoidance. So what do you think this entails? CSMA, what does that mean? Carrier sense, multiple access. So a Wi-Fi host will, before transmitting, listen and not transmit if the channel is already busy. That's the CSMA part. Remember, CD was, once it starts transmitting, if it hears somebody else come on the channel, they both stop. So what's the problem with CD, given what I've told you earlier today? Why is that going to be a problem? Why will that not be such a good thing? Yes, Zachary.
There's too much collisions, nothing will ever happen.
Well, I think you could try to make the same argument about wired. So what's different in the wireless case? Call it. No, just a hand up.
Anybody else?
Suppose we're relying on collision detection. A is transmitting its signal. C is transmitting as well. If we have the hidden terminal problem, maybe A can't hear C at all. But even if we don't have the hidden terminal problem, remember what I said about signal strength. At A, its own signal is really, really strong, right? C's signal is much weaker. It will be very hard for A to hear C while it is transmitting. It may be impossible for A to hear C at all, but even if A could hear C, if it was quiet, while it is transmitting, it's very likely that it will be able to hear C. So collision detection is essentially an impossible problem for these radios. So we end up with collision avoidance. I'll tell you how that works here in a second. Bit of terminology. Why? I don't know. A base station together with the host that it talks to is called a basic service cell. Almost as arbitrary a name as 802.11. But that's what it is. And notice that our access point here, this guy, is connected to typically a hub switch or a router using a wired connection. And these days, of course, often this hub switch or router is physically integrated in the same box as the base station. You've probably got these boxes, right? Well, actually, all the ones that I have are a base station, a switch, and a router, all built in the same box. But they're really logically three separate devices that physically as well. Okay, hosts associate with an access point. You're used to that. You've seen this. Have you looked at your system logs to see what happens when you walk into a new place and it tries to connect to the network? There's a negotiation that goes on, and eventually you select an access point. Here at WSU, you also have to do authentication. Hopefully at your house you do as well. If you don't, fix that, please. We'll talk about that in the security chapter, but if you're running an open access point, probably not such a great idea. And then the hosts will sort of be ordinary network hosts. I guess we'll start here next time. So the plan, let me tell you about the plan. Wednesday, no class. No class here, watch the video. Friday, I will introduce the next project, which is the proxy server project. And if there's time, I will go on with this. Otherwise, we will continue with this on next Monday. And then after that, we will move on to security. That's the plan. Okay? So get those projects turned in tonight, please. And have fun.